Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's February 17th, Thursday. Had a test last time. We're going to move on to Chapter 4 today. And your test has been graded. Most of the grades have been put in Blackboard, unless I didn't see an ID from you, or maybe if you didn't put your Scantron in the correct lab section, I didn't know where it belonged. Can't figure it out, so see me during office hours or maybe a little bit right after class, and I can show you your grade if you didn't get a grade yet. And also, here is a sign-in sheet, and I have a little note here for one student that I need to know what your CRN number is so that I can include your grade in Blackboard. Because don't forget, there's multiple courses in this one course right here. So there's a sign-in sheet. I can't mention your name because we're recording. All right, so we're going to talk about enzymes today. I got a good email via regarding a question that's online. We'll review that question because it's a little flaky. The question is really good, but the answer is just a little bit flaky. So I'll tell you what I like in terms of an answer for that one question regarding enzymes. Okay, so we're going to talk about enzymes, some metabolic pathways, and bioenergetics today. But I want to give you a definition of a chemical reaction. We've looked at some chemical reactions already in class. But to think of everything that we're going to talk about today, make sure that you understand that the general form of a chemical reaction is when we have reactants, and we're just going to call these A and B, but they could be any number of molecules, but A plus B, these are reactants. Usually we put these on the left-hand side of a chemical equation, followed with an arrow going to what? C plus, I don't know, we'll just say D. So these are the products on the right-hand side of our equation right here. All right, and some chemical reactions are one-way, some are two-way streets, depending on the energy levels between these reactants and products. So when we think of chemistry, think of this chemical reaction right here. And since we're going to be talking about enzymes, enzymes allow this reaction to proceed. Okay, so some chemical reactions are catalyzed with an enzyme, and maybe we would put the name of that enzyme right here. All right, so that's just a really quick introduction to chemistry and enzymes. All right, so what the heck are enzymes? We call them biological catalysts. All right, so they're a catalyst of some kind, but they're also biomolecules that increase the rate of a chemical reaction. So a catalyst cannot make a reaction happen that will not happen automatically by itself, but it speeds up the rate, so it's a lot faster. Some chemical reactions might take thousands or millions of years to take place, but if there's an enzyme catalyzing that reaction, it might take place in milliseconds, less than a second, right? So it speeds up the rate of a reaction. And that's really good for your biochemistry because if there's an important reaction in your body, you can't afford to wait around millions of years for it to happen, right? Okay, the other nice thing about enzymes is that they can be controlled. They can be turned on or turned off depending on the needs of the cell. And there's something else about catalysts, and that is a catalyst is not used up during the reaction, right? It can catalyze that same reaction over and over and over again and is not altered by that particular reaction. Most biological catalysts are proteins. There are some that are RNA molecules, but by far most of them are proteins, and you learned a lot about proteins already. You know the basic building block of a protein is an amino acid. But what gives a protein its activity really is its three-dimensional shape. And it can be a very complicated shape because you can put thousands of amino acids together in all kinds of different arrangements, right, in any kind of linear sequence to form just an unlimited number of different three-dimensional shapes. All right, and enzymes act, this statement right here, the action of an enzyme, you can't appreciate right now, but we're going to talk about that, but at least I want to put it on this list. You should know that enzymes increase the rate of a chemical reaction by lowering the activation energy for that particular reaction. All right, so that's what we want to talk about first. So don't get those two concepts mixed up. An enzyme increases the rate of a reaction by what? Lowering its activation energy. So here is a pretty nice slide in your book, a number of graphs. Let's look at this first column, these first two graphs. So what are these graphs plotting? Number of reactant molecules. All right, so on this chemical equation right here, where do you see reactants? right over here on the left-hand side. So that we're looking at the number of reactant molecules, right, versus their, oh, maybe I didn't put my cursor on right here. Let me make sure I have that on. It is visible. Okay. Okay, so the number of reactant molecules and plotted versus energy. So if we have a reactant molecule or a whole set of reactant molecules, millions, maybe a whole mole of them in a test tube someplace, they don't have all exactly the same energy level. They're close, right? And you measure that energy level by putting a thermometer in the solution and you can figure out what their energy level is. It's just the molecular vibration of molecules. And every molecule is going to have a little bit different one. And if we plot all the energy of all those molecules in that test tube out, okay, versus the number of them right here, we see that it's a bell-shaped distribution. They all don't just have exactly one. There's some distribution of energy levels. And this might be a fairly narrow graph, right? But nonetheless, they're not all exactly the same. So for a particular reaction that we have drawn on down here on the lower part of this slide, a few of these molecules have enough energy to undergo this reaction right here. But not all of them, only a small portion. That looks like maybe 10%, maybe 15% of the molecules have enough energy to go from reaction to products, right? So we're just talking about any kind of generic reaction. In order for that to happen, if we plot energy versus the non-catalyzed reaction right here, right, we see that reactant molecules give up energy to become products. Right? So that is a very favorable reaction when that happens. Reactions proceed very nicely when they can give up energy to become products. So these reactants right here would love to become products because they'll give up energy. They'll lose energy to do that. All right, but in this particular circumstance, it can't because here is a little barrier that's preventing these molecules from reacting with each other. All right, so this is what we consider the activation energy, or energy of activation, or some kind of energy barrier that's preventing molecules. So you could think again of maybe my car sitting on top of the hill, and of course my car wants to roll down the hill, but it can't because there's this big wall, or you could put a block or a chalk underneath the tire right there, and it won't roll down the hill. Right? It wants to, but it can't because of this activation energy. All right, what an enzyme does, if we put these reactant molecules in solution with an enzyme, notice now that the energy distribution is exactly the same, and we didn't slide this graph back and forth, so this energy access is exactly the same. But now, let's look at the number of molecules that have sufficient energy to proceed with this reaction. Is it greater or less? It's greater. Now we're up by 50%. Let me turn some of these lights off. I just realized I have these lights on. It might be hard to see. Which ones would we like to turn off? That one? Yeah, just like that. Okay, so that probably helps quite a bit. Okay, so an enzyme increases the number of molecules that have sufficient activation energy to proceed through the reaction. So what is that like? That's like reducing the height of this barrier right here so that more molecules, more reactant molecules can give up energy to become products. So that's what enzymes do. So that speeds up the rate of a reaction. Now, that's a pretty abstract kind of way of thinking about activation energy. All right, but what is an enzyme really doing? We're talking about three-dimensional shapes. So let's just say that these two markers that I have in my hand are A and B, and they're going to undergo a reaction, all right, to become, let's just say instead of C and D, let's just call it C. All right, so these two markers are going to join together to form one product molecule, and here's the product molecule. Right, so here's just a simple molecule. They've joined together. Now, how do these two markers have to be put together in order to form a product molecule? Can we put them together like this? No. Can we put them together like that? All right. Or like this? Or like that? Okay. Or even like this? That's a different one because this is the one that we started out with. All right, so this is the one we really want. Or like that? Or like this? So how many millions of ways can we put these two markers together? Okay, but if we do that in just a random way, they're not going to form products. There's only one way that they're going to form products, and that is if we put them together just in that one exact way, they'll form a product. And that's what an enzyme does. It takes these two substrates, right, and aligns them so that just the right parts of those two molecules come together with the right orientation so that it's not just a futile bumping in, right? It's just a very nice, efficient mechanism so the right parts of these two reactant molecules touch each other and they can then form a product. That's the same thing as saying that the activation energy has decreased. All right, so that's maybe how you should think about it. All right, so the ability of enzymes to lower the activation energy requirement is due to structure. All right, so we're going to look at that. Enzymes have a highly ordered three-dimensional shape because they're proteins. It has a conformation. All right, and they can contain pockets in them that we call active sites into which the substrates fit into. Now, if it's an enzyme-catalyzed reaction, we don't really call these reactants over here. If it's enzyme-catalyzed, then we want to call these things substrates instead of just plain old reactants. But they're basically the same kind of thing. All right, so enzymes act by bringing the substrates close together in just the right orientation so that a product is formed. So here's an exam figure for you. All right, so here we have an enzyme, and it's a relatively large molecule. It's larger than the substrates usually, and it has a nice three-dimensional conformation, has a specific kind of shape, and here is one active site that can bind substrate A. Here is a second active site that can bind substrate B, and this active site has to be complementary in shape to the shape of the substrate so that they fit together. Sometimes we use a lock and key model. Right, a key will only fit into a lock if it has the right shape. Sometimes you use a hand and glove model to describe how a substrate binds to an enzyme. And we've kind of looked at that already in terms of, I think, with transporters. The molecule that's being transported has to fit into an active site of the transporter within the membrane, and it has to have the right shape, and when it does, it can bind. Same thing for enzymes. So you could actually think of a transporter as being an enzyme, right, but just carrying a molecule across a membrane. Okay, so substrate A can bind to this active site. Can substrate A bind to this active site down over here? No, it doesn't have the right shape, right? So these active sites are very specific for these particular molecules. And we learned that was a very important term for membrane transport as well. All right, so an enzyme then will bind the substrates and it forms a complex that we call the enzyme-substrate complex right here. This is a necessary step that has to happen before products can form. So now we see that the substrates are put together in just the right way, and part of A is going to be transferred to B, all right? And when that happens, they're going to be released from the active site, and then we end up with product C and product D over here, and we get the enzyme back. All right, so here is just a nice chemical equation that describes A plus B going to C plus D with the help of this enzyme. So if the enzyme is present, what can you tell me about the rate of formation of C and D compared to if there was no enzyme present? It's a lot faster. That's the whole job of an enzyme, right? It increases the rate of C and D production, or we would call that the rate of this particular chemical reaction. All right, so this enzyme-substrate complex has to form before products can. All right, then the products dissociate. But now, look at this enzyme right here. What can you tell me about the shape of the enzyme after the reaction compared to the shape before the reaction? It's the same. What about the color? It's the same. What about the shading in there? It's the same, right? So what's the difference between the enzyme before the reaction compared to the enzyme after the reaction? It's exactly the same, right? There's no difference whatsoever, okay, in the three-dimensional shape, which is the important part of this enzyme activity. So guess what's going to happen if we change the shape of this enzyme right here? Maybe by putting it in a high salt solution. That's going to change all the hydration shells around this protein right here. What's going to happen to the shape of this enzyme? Yeah, or if we put it in a different kind of pH, a non-physiologic pH, the shape is going to change, right? Or maybe a temperature, the shape is going to change. The conformation of this enzyme is going to change. So if the shape of this enzyme changes, so does the active site. And so then it loses affinity for these substrates, which means then that the enzyme-substrate complex can't form or can form only with difficulty. So what's going to happen to the rate of the chemical reaction? It's going to slow down or even stop if you change the shape of this particular enzyme right here. So that's a really important consideration. All right, so that's some things about enzymes. And let's look at that one question that was online. Where's the online question? Do I have it someplace? Maybe right over here. Okay, the screen has to figure itself out. It re-justifies. Oh, it's not going to do that. Here's an online question. Maybe some of you have seen this one already. All right, an enzyme has all of the following properties except. All right, and here are the answers. All right, the computer's still figuring out how to put the screen together. All right, it increases the rate of a chemical reaction. True or false?
True,
definitely true. It is not permanently changed by the reaction it catalyzes. That's true. Okay. It increases the energy yield of a chemical reaction. Okay, that's the one that's false. Now, let's see. I thought there was four answers to this question. Okay. It does not change. Oh, here. Now, the online says it does not change what the products of a chemical reaction will be or should be or something. Or maybe that's just it right there. So let's go back and look at this PowerPoint slide. Let's go back one right here. All right, so the rate of a chemical reaction definitely increases because it's putting these substrates together. The enzyme is not altered by the chemical reaction. All right, it increases the energy yield. Ah, let's look at that one. Let's go back to this slide right here. What is the energy yield? That's the difference in energy between reactants and products. This is without the enzyme, this is with the enzyme. What can you tell me about this energy, this amount of energy, and this amount of energy right here on this diagram? It's exactly the same. What's the only thing that changed? The amount of energy of this activation barrier right here, right? So over here with the question, the wrong one is it increases the energy yield from a chemical reaction. It does not increase the yield. The yield is exactly the same. So the thermodynamics is the same. So this is, you might get that one wrong online, but if I put it on a test, don't get this one wrong on a test. Now what about this one? It does not change what the products of a chemical reaction are. Well, let me go back to the slide over here. That's really misleading. I don't agree with that statement. Because we said we have substrates A and B going to C. One of the beautiful things about enzymes compared to if we were just to mix these chemicals up in a test tube and let the reaction work without an enzyme is that enzymes are so specific that they will only allow this product to be formed. But in real life, without an enzyme, there might be a way for these two molecules to do what? Bump into each other to make this kind of molecule right here, which is not C. This is something else. All right, so there are side reactions that can happen in non-enzyme catalyzed reactions that put together all kinds of molecules that your body would not want. So you can put A and B together in many different ways to get different kinds of compounds, but what your body does, it puts A and B together in only that one important way that's beneficial for your body. So that's hugely important. All right, your body doesn't undergo a number of futile reactions. So do you see this question right here, how to approach the correct answer to this question right here? All right, if not, then come see me during office hours. So that's important. So that figure was an exam figure with the enzyme substrate complex. Nope. Sorry. This is what we want right here. Okay. So let's talk about some nomenclature. Most enzymes, at least when in the last 20 years or so, when we've had agreement on modern nomenclature, most enzymes have an ASE as a suffix. So when you see a word with an ASE at the end of it, you know it is an enzyme, which does what? Speeds up the rate of some kind of chemical reaction. And maybe the rest of the name tells you what kind of reaction it is. All right, so enzymes sometimes are placed in a class. So sometimes we call these phosphatases. Phosphatases work on chemicals that have a phosphate group on them, an inorganic phosphate PI or PO4 group, and a phosphatase removes that phosphate group from a molecule. It could be a protein, for instance. All right, so if you have an enzyme that takes a phosphate group off, you might have an enzyme that puts a phosphate group on, and it has a different name. That's what we call a kinase. So any kind of kinase enzyme will put a phosphate group on a molecule, maybe a protein. And that phosphate group is a pretty big group, so when it's put on an enzyme, it can change, subtly change the conformation of that enzyme. So what's going to happen to that enzyme if it undergoes a conformation change as a phosphate group is put onto it? The activity is going to change. but we don't know exactly if it will increase or decrease. Some enzyme activity increases when they're phosphorylated. Some enzyme activity decreases when they're phosphorylated. We're going to learn numerous enzymes, okay, and we'll see examples of both of those cases. Okay, so you make sure you know phosphatase versus kinase. Practice that one 10 times a day for the next 5 days. You'll have it down cold, okay? All right. The name may specify the substrate of the enzyme and the activity, such as lactate dehydrogenase. So the substrate for this particular enzyme is lactate. That's a molecule that we're going to look at in the next chapter. And it's a dehydrogenase because it takes off a hydrogen atom and probably an electron as well. It removes an electron and a hydrogen from lactate. And that's going to change that chemical compound. Here are some enzymes that are real important in Table 4.2. And let's see. Probably you should become familiar with all of these. Catalase will take hydrogen peroxide and convert it into water and oxygen. Hydrogen peroxide is a very reactive chemical that sometimes does become produced in cells, right? But it's a damaging molecule, should be around in your cells. So there are things called peroxisomes, right, that contain peroxidase or catalase, which then breaks down hydrogen peroxide into water and oxygen. All right, so hydrogen peroxide that you have at home, does it want to turn into water and oxygen all by itself, even though there's no enzyme in there? You know what? It does. That's why they put it in that really dark bottle. Because if you take hydrogen peroxide, which you have maybe in your medicine cabinet at home, put it in that clear glass, put it in the window where there's a lot of sun hitting it, the temperature goes up, a lot of energy increases, then it's going to just break down to water and oxygen very quickly, okay, probably in a matter of weeks. So if you have, even if you have a hydrogen peroxide bottle at home in that dark container in your medicine cabinet and it's been sitting there for 30 years, guess what you have in that bottle? You probably have mostly water and oxygen because it has a tendency to break down all by itself. But now if you take some really nice hydrogen peroxide that hasn't broken down yet and put it on your skin, what do you see right away happening? It bubbles, and what are those bubbles? That is, sorry about my cursor. I'm still learning how to drive this machine here. That's oxygen, right, which inhibits bacterial growth, right, and it also has a tendency to flush the wound and get debris out of a wound, so it's nice to put on lacerations and things like that, and water, which then washes the wound out as well, okay? And so why is it then when you pour hydrogen peroxide on damaged tissue, you see all these bubbles forming, and also water is forming at the exact same time? Why is that? Because what's in your body? You have, yeah, this enzyme right here, which does what? Speeds up the rate of that chemical reaction, right? So that is catalase, so you could say peroxidase. Carbonic anhydrase is another enzyme that interconverts carbonic acid and CO2. And also producing water right here. That's going to be a really important, I think, carbonic anhydrase. Maybe you even had to know that one for the first test. Okay, amylase is an enzyme that will take starch. Does anybody remember what the building block of starch is? It's a carbohydrate. Ah, but which one? Yeah, carbohydrate is a sugar. But which one? In particular, I'm thinking of a monosaccharide. So a monosaccharide is a building block of starch, but give me the specific name of that monosaccharide. It is glucose, right? So starch is just a polymer of glucose, and amylase breaks starch down into maltose, which is a disaccharide, but each of the monosaccharides that are used to make maltose is glucose, okay? And then there are other enzymes that will break maltose down into those two glucose molecules, okay? Now, what kind of reaction is that? Starch plus water producing maltose. That is a hydrolysis reaction, right? Hydrolysis reaction. Okay, lactate dehydrogenase takes lactic acid, converts it into pyruvic acid, and produces a couple hydrogens, which are trapped by other parts of your body and used. Ribonuclease takes an RNA molecule. What's the building block of RNA? It's a ribonucleotide, right? It's a ribonucleotide. And water produces, oh, it's right here. It breaks it down to its building blocks. What kind of reaction is that? Here's a hint, similar to amylase. It's a hydrolysis reaction, right? Okay. So These RNA molecules are relatively stable, okay, except that your cells produce ribonuclease to break them down eventually so they don't build up. Or if RNA molecules from other animals or plants get into your body, they're destroyed. Right? You should only have your RNA molecules inside your body. All right, so enzyme activity is the rate substrates are converted to products. Right? Substrates converted to products tell us something about this enzyme activity. If this enzyme is taken away, then what happens to the rate of conversion into products if we take the enzyme away? It slows way down. Now, if we put a little bit of enzyme in there, we get a little bit faster conversion of substrates to products. If we put a lot of enzyme in there, we get what? A lot of products in a hurry. So the rate of conversion of substrates to products is dependent on the enzyme concentration and activity. And all enzymes, right, if we increase the energy of a system by increasing the temperature, the enzyme activity increases as we increase temperature. More products will be formed. That's why we refrigerate our foods, to slow those chemical processes that will denature our food or rancify our food. Right? We slow those chemical processes down by putting them in the refrigerator. All right, so enzymes have an optimal temperature and pH ranges because temperature and pH determine what? The conformation of an enzyme, which then determines what? Defines the active site and how well substrates can bind to the enzyme to form that enzyme-substrate complex. So most enzymes work pretty well near physiologic values. Like, what's a good physiologic pH? 7.35. All right, you might find some environments in your body that are drastically different from that, like in the stomach, right? A pH around 2, small intestine, pH is up around 8, okay? But don't forget, this is all due to the three-dimensional structure of an enzyme. All right, but notice, once we get right around 40 degrees or so, and we increase the temperature, then we lose enzyme activity rather rapidly. So what's happening there? Denaturation is occurring. So much conformation change to that enzyme has occurred that the active site is destroyed, and you still have that enzyme there, right? But the active site is gone, so you can't form. What can't form if the active site is gone? What can't form? The products can't form, but what's the step before products, which is the key to thinking about this? The enzyme-substrate complex can't form if the active sites are gone. And if that enzyme-substrate complex can't form, neither can the products, right? So that's the thing that you should think about. The other thing is, after we've denatured an enzyme and then we cool it back down, maybe to a physiologic temperature, does the enzyme activity return? It does not, because that's what we mean by denaturation. It's an irreversible process. Once we denature a protein, we can't get its natural conformation back. It only assumes its native configuration as it's being made. As one amino acid is added to that growing protein, it kind of folds into the right shape. But if after the whole protein is made, after we unfold it, there's really no way to get it back into that native configuration. Okay. Now, I think we've talked about this before. Did we talk about denaturation before? Yes, we did. I gave you an example with shooting pool, did I not? We did not? Okay, I'll give it to you. I'll relate that experience to you. All right, so I'm going to go home tonight, and I've got some hamburgers. And what does a cooked hamburger compared to a raw hamburger look like? Different? Definitely different, right? So you cook a hamburger, it changes, all those proteins change conformation, right? And then I got disturbed. I got called out to shoot some pool with some of my friends, and I said, okay, well, I'm going to put these hamburgers, they're almost ready to eat, in the refrigerator, cool them back down. Do they go back to looking like raw hamburger again? No, because what did we do? We denatured all those proteins. Okay, so that's an irreversible process. All right, so many enzymes have an optimal activity if you plot it out with temperature and pH and salt concentration and other things. So here's a graph of enzyme activity, which is what? The rate of formation of products versus pH. Most enzymes have an optimal pH right around 7, like salivary amylase. And salivary amylase is produced by salivary glands. It's working in your mouth to break starch down into maltose. And for people, that's not a very important process because we don't chew our food for very long compared to like cows, for instance, right, or other kinds of ruminants, All right, but that's just a little vestigial enzyme activity. But we have other places, like in the stomach, pepsin will have an optimal pH closer to 1. All right, and that drastic pH is necessary to break those peptide bonds, which are difficult to break. So it has to be a very strange environment, but this enzyme right here has evolved or has been selected to work at that particular pH to undergo some initial digestion of proteins. Trypsin, on the other hand, works in the small intestine, where the pH then switches from basically maybe 1.5 up to 8 or 9, right, which then will break other kinds of peptide bonds between various amino acids. All right, so different enzymes will have different optimal pHs. So here is just a list of some enzymes and what their optimal pH is. And if they're found in the usual part of your body, they have pretty much the usual kind of physiologic pH. I don't think I want you to know any of these in particular, except, okay, if we say phosphatase, you should probably know something about that activity. What does a phosphatase do? Okay, it removes a phosphate group. All right, what is antagonistic to a phosphatase? A kinase, right? Phosphatase takes a phosphate off, a kinase adds it on there. So these enzymes are antagonistic to each other, and that's probably the most important point in this class. And that is, when you're in a healthy, disease-free state, your body is in balance. And how does your body maintain balance? Through the interaction of what? Antagonistic systems, whether it's musculoskeletal or nervous system, or here is an enzyme system, a phosphatase working against a kinase. That's how your body maintains precise control and balance. All right, so phosphatase is important to know. We don't have any kinases in this list right here. But just, I think you should know what the opposite of a phosphatase is. Okay, some enzymes require other kinds of factors besides substrates in order for them to have activity. And we would call these things cofactors or coenzymes. And you might know other definitions for these terms, but just know these definitions for this class. And actually, this is a really nice way of thinking of cofactors and coenzymes. All right, a cofactor are very small inorganic compounds, like metal ions right here, like calcium, magnesium, manganese, copper, zinc, a little bit of selenium, that will maybe bind to an enzyme. And when it binds, it changes the shape of the enzyme, which does what? If it changes the shape, it changes the function or activity of that enzyme. It could increase the activity or decrease the activity. All depends. Okay. So a cofactor is a very small metal ion. A coenzyme, on the other hand, what can you tell me about an enzyme that we just learned about? What are they like? Are they really small molecules, inorganic molecules? They're what? They're biological molecules, mostly proteins. And proteins are big, huge, complicated molecules. So a coenzyme is a lot bigger and a lot more complicated than a cofactor, right? So it's more like an enzyme. So it's an organic molecule that is large. Most coenzymes are derived from vitamins. And what can you tell me about a vitamin? They're an essential nutrient. Essential just means that your body cannot make them on its own. You need to have that in your diet in order for these chemical reactions to take place. So a coenzyme will transport small molecules between different enzymes. It's like a little carrier molecule that hands off an important molecule from one set of reactions to another set of chemical reactions. That's a coenzyme. All right, so let's look at some examples of cofactors. All right, when a cofactor binds to an enzyme, it changes the conformation of the active site. And in this particular case, it enhances the binding of substrates to the active site. So here we have a cofactor. In this first case, it binds to a site where? Is it the same site as the active sites? It's a different site. So here's the active site here. Here's the active site for substrate B. But here is the binding site for the cofactor. If it binds to a site other than the active site, we call that allosteric binding. Allosteric binding. So it binds right here. It enhances the binding of these substrates to the enzyme. So what happens after this step right here? Product formation. Okay? So it speeds up, this cofactor speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction. Or it could actually bind, a cofactor could bind to the active site, enhancing the shape, the matching of the shape between this active site and the substrates. That's not allosteric. Right? That's just usual, just binding of a cofactor to an enzyme. All right, so you see the little bit difference right here? In this first case, it binds to a site other than the active site, and then this one right here is in the active site. Sometimes this will inhibit an enzyme, right? And sometimes it will activate the enzyme. And what we see in this case, both of these cases, are activation of the enzyme, right? So it enhances the formation of the enzyme substrate complex. Many enzymes are produced in an inactive form. So they don't have activity in the site where they are produced or made. For instance, in the pancreas that produces digestive enzymes, for instance, like trypsin, chymotrypsin, they're not activated, which is a good thing, because if they were activated, what would trypsin and chymotrypsin do in the pancreas? Would digest the pancreas down. And unfortunately, that happens to people when they have pancreatitis or pancreas cancer. Okay? And that's like the worst thing in the world that can happen to you. Okay? But since these digestive enzymes are produced by the pancreas, which is an exocrine gland, at least that part of it, these precursors to enzymes are transported to the digestive tract via the pancreatic duct, and then they're converted into the active form where they then now have their activity for digestion, but that's a proper place because the small intestine knows, usually if it's healthy, how to protect itself from self-digestion of those enzymes. Ooh, does anybody know what the probably the most important chemical is that protects the lining of the stomach and the small intestine so it doesn't get digested or dissolved in the hydrochloric acid that the stomach produces? It's just mucus. And mucus is a protein, and you know, proteins are really tough. Mucus is even especially tougher. All right, so many enzymes are activated by phosphorylation, and they're inactivated by dephosphorylation. So to phosphorylate something, what kind of enzyme would you want? We've got to practice this a lot of times. You would use a kinase. Okay, to dephosphorylate, you would use a phosphatase. All right, so anytime you see any kind of antagonism in this class, that's a good thing, and you really got a key on that information. Okay, others are activated by ligands, small molecules, maybe called second messengers. So where do second messengers come from? First messengers that bind to plasma membrane receptors, right? And then there's some kind of transduction pathway that produces second messengers, which can activate enzymes inside of a cell, then change the physiology inside the cell. What's a really nice way of making a second messenger inside the cell? Very, very ancient, old transduction scheme. And it was on your exam, or at least you had to know it for your exam. I don't know if it was on your exam or not. Was a G-protein coupled receptor, right? So a G-protein coupled receptor binds the first messenger outside the cell, activates G-proteins inside the cell, which then can maybe bump into an enzyme, phosphorylate it, turn that activity on inside the cell, so now the activity inside the cell changes as a result. Okay. All right, so here, what's the effect of substrate concentration on the rate of a reaction? Well, because once an active site is bound to a substrate, it can't accept another substrate until the reaction has taken place. So typically, as the substrate concentration increases, the reaction rate increases. So this is a plot of reaction rate versus substrate concentration for an enzyme. And we can see that if we hold the enzyme concentration constant and we increase substrate concentration, the rate of conversion of substrates to product increases, but we see it starts to slow down, and it even reaches a plateau right here. We call that saturation. At that point, all of the enzyme has bound substrate molecules, and no other substrates can bind to an enzyme because they're already all occupied with substrate. And even though you have increasing concentrations in substrate, you don't have an increase in what? That enzyme-substrate complex, because all the enzymes are already occupied with substrate. So the enzyme reaction can't proceed any faster as a result. So we call that saturation. And you saw that for transporters as well. So enzymes and transporters kind of mimic each other in the way that we think about them. Okay, some reactions are reversible. Both the forward and backward reactions can be catalyzed by the same enzyme. So in that particular case, on our diagram right here, we would want to put a bidirectional arrow, like that. And that then would say that the energy of the products is pretty much equal to the combined energy of the substrates right here. So the products can be converted back to substrates, or substrates can be converted into products just as easily, backwards and forwards. So there still might be an activation barrier between them, but there's no net release of energy into any system. So we call this the law of mass action. So how do we know what's going to form? So here we have A plus B going to C, and you have a nice bidirectional arrow. So how do we know which way this chemical reaction is going to work? It's kind of like a teeter-totter. So if we put somebody really heavy on one end, what's going to happen to the teeter-totter? It's going to move down to that end, right? And if we put somebody even heavier on the other end, what's going to happen? It's going to go back the other way. So instead of weight, think of concentration of these compounds right here. So here is a chemical reaction catalyzed by carbonic anhydrase. If the law of mass action states that if we increase the amount of CO2 for this reaction, it's going to force it to the right. All right, so if we increase the concentration of anything on the left, it's going to force the reaction to the right. Or if we increase the concentration of carbonic acid, it's going to force the reaction to the left. All right, so it's just going to form a balance, and eventually the right concentrations will build up and the reaction will stop. Conversely, if we remove CO2 from this beaker or this chemical system we have operating someplace, which way is the chemical reaction going to proceed? If we remove CO2, it's going to move it back to the left to build up some CO2 that's taken out. Okay, so you could probably imagine, well, gee whiz, you know, I'm breathing out CO2 all the time. I have this enzyme in my body. So what's happening to carbonic acid as I breathe out CO2? What's happening to carbonic acid inside my body? It's decreasing as a result of just your rate of respiration. Right, and that's going to affect the pH of your body. So respiratory rate does affect the pH of your body when we get into the respiratory system. So this law has another name. Oh, rats, and I don't have it on the slide right here, and I don't know how to spell it. I'll tell you next time. It is Le Chatelier's principle. Maybe some of you have looked at that principle before, but Le Chatelier's principle is the exact same thing as the law of mass action. So in chemistry, they usually call it Le Chatelier's principle. Physiology, I don't know why they don't call it that. Okay? All right. I probably don't know how to pronounce it either. So you probably can't look it up on Google by listening to the tape. Yes?
Question.
Yeah? I tell you what, let's practice that. That's not bad. But it's not just moving right or left by this definition right here. It has to do with a phosphate molecule. So let's say A has a phosphate group, an inorganic phosphate group bound to it. And so this is just one molecule, okay? And it combines with another one to form this plus inorganic phosphate. That's a separate molecule by itself. So what kind of enzyme is going to take this phosphate off of A and put it over here? That is what we call a phosphatase. That's a phosphatase. Okay. Now, phosphatases and kinases, okay, are never reversible reactions. There's usually a big change in energy. So we can't have a double arrow right here. There has to be another enzyme. There has to be a different mechanism in how it works in order to go backwards. So here's enzyme one. If we're going to go backwards with C plus PI going to PIA plus B right here, that's got to be a totally different enzyme. So we got to say enzyme number two. And going this way, adding a phosphate to a group. Now you're kind of thinking backwards just a little bit, but adding a phosphate to C, what kind of enzyme is that? That is a kinase. Yeah, so I could see where you might think of one arrow going right or left, but it's always two drastically different kinds of chemical reactions because there's big changes in energy right here. Okay. Another way of saying that, if I can flip back, let me see if I can flip back You're going to get dizzy. Don't watch the screen. Let me go back to like one of those first diagrams. This one right here. A kinase reaction and a phosphatase reaction, there's a big change in energy. So the product does not like to go back uphill. Okay? But if it was like the carbonic anhydrase reaction, there would be no hill. You would have reactants turned into products at the same energy level. There could be an activation energy barrier, right? But they're going to hop back and forth at the same energy level. But if there's an enzyme present, it still reduces this activation energy barrier, so they just hop back and forth quicker. Okay. But for a phosphatase and kinase, there's a big change in energy. Okay. All right, so let's go back to chemical reactions. Here we go. Metabolic pathways. All right, so metabolic pathway is pretty much just an extension of our basic equation for a chemical reaction. It's a set of chemical reactions where the products of one chemical reaction actually become the substrate for the next chemical reaction. And the products of the second chemical reaction become the substrates for the next chemical reaction. All right, so it's just a number of steps. So they are sequences of enzymatic reactions that begin with an initial substrate, which progress through various intermediates, that's an important term, various intermediates, and end with a final product. So here is the first enzymatic reaction where we have B formed and then another enzyme converts it to C and then another enzyme to D and another enzyme to E. B, C, D, and E are what we call intermediates in this metabolic pathway. Okay, and then here we have a final product. So this is a nice metabolic pathway. We're going to actually pay quite a bit of attention to these various metabolic pathways in your body. Okay, so let's talk about how your body might control these metabolic pathways through some kind of end product inhibition. So here we have some initial substrate A, and via a number of steps, here we have a nice metabolic pathway. It can be converted into F. For instance, if your body needs some F, it can utilize this metabolic pathway right here. But here is a second pathway. Once you get to C, maybe we have another pathway that can convert this initial substrate A into a different final product that we call F prime. Now, as F prime builds up inside your body, do you think your body needs typically more or less of F prime? Think of this in terms of homeostasis, right? And your body should have what? Kind of a set point for this particular molecule. Doesn't need too much, and it's bad if you have too little. It needs just the right amount. So as your body builds up F prime, right, F prime by diffusion might bump into enzyme number 3 and bind to a site other than the active site and change its activity. In this particular case, since there's plenty of F prime in your body, it will bind to this enzyme and turn the activity off. So that's what we're going to call feedback inhibition or allosteric inhibition, because F prime is not binding to an active site, it's binding to a regulatory site on the enzyme. All right? But that regulatory site, you could almost think of as an active site. It's just not catalyzing a reaction. It's got to have the right shape to what? That's complementary in shape to F prime right here. And when you turn off this particular pathway, then this alternative pathway can be turned on, and the substrates here can be converted into other kinds of products as a result. So your body can figure out how to control what A is going to be turned into via allosteric regulation, via what? End product. So F prime is an end product that feeds back usually to a branch point in metabolism to switch metabolism from one pathway to another. All right, so allosteric inhibition is a form of end product inhibition if we include this metabolic pathway right here. Okay. All right, bioenergetics. We're going to be interested in energy. Who knows something about energy? What is energy? What is energy? Energy is ATP. Yeah, ATP is good in your body. What does ATP allow you to do? Run around, think, study, right? Stay awake, breathe, all that kind of stuff, right? So ATP does have energy in it, but I want to think of energy just in its like physics context. Energy is the ability to do work. That's what energy is. So without ATP in your body, you can't do any work, right? Probably forever, because you're dead. So energy is the ability to do work. When you have When you feel like you have a lot of energy, what can you do? A lot of work, right? And when you feel like you're low on energy, then you can't work very much at all, right? So that's kind of just a loose analogy of energy. But energy, you should probably write down, is the ability to do work. And we're going to think about how energy moves. Did I pass the sign-in sheet around yet? No? Yes? No? Yeah, good. Okay. All right, so it's going around. Don't forget that sign-in sheet, not energy sheet, sign-in sheet. Okay, so bioenergetics is a field of study of how energy flows through biological systems like your body. And it's got to obey all the thermodynamic laws of energy transfer or energy that all other systems, whether living or not, okay, in our universe. So there are two laws that describe energy, how it flows. The first law of thermodynamics, thermodynamics is concerned with what? The flow of energy, states that energy cannot or can be transformed, but it cannot be created or destroyed. So the amount of energy in our universe is constant. It doesn't change, right? But it can go from high to low, or low to high, different ways, okay? So it can move around, but it cannot be created or destroyed. So that's going to be important. It's a zero-sum game. The second law states that energy transformation increases entropy of the system that we're considering. And entropy is just the degree of disorganization or randomness within a system. Right? So only free energy, which is energy in an organized state. So if we take a molecule like glucose, which is a big molecule put together in just a very specific way, it's highly organized. Right? It has a lot of free energy, and we can break it down into smaller molecules that vibrate around all over the place, becomes very random. Okay, so glucose can break down to carbon dioxide and water very easily because carbon dioxide and water are much more random compared to the highly organized state that glucose is in with all those carbon molecules. So glucose has a high degree of free energy, carbon dioxide and water have very low free energy, so molecules can go from highly organized to highly disorganized, and when that happens, that energy can be used to do work. So that energy can be siphoned off somehow and used. All right, so systems have a tendency to go from states of high free energy to low free energy, like that very first energy diagram that we looked at. And I suppose I could flip back there really quick once again. Okay, so here we have reactants at what? A high level of free energy, and after products are formed, then low free energy as a result. Okay, so then that will be a nice spontaneous reaction. Okay, so here these are the two laws. So here we have, again, a diagram of free energy, and we're going to look at various substrates and products. So here we're taking carbon dioxide and water, and not we, unfortunately. I wish I could do this. Okay, carbon dioxide and water, and this plant can make glucose out of it. It can join all of these carbon dioxide molecules right here to produce glucose. Right, and glucose, if we just look over at the energy scale, and if we look at carbon dioxide and water on the energy scale, which has more free energy, CO2 or glucose? Okay, energy increases as we go up the scale right here. So glucose has much more free energy. But we said that what? Reactions only take place if this free energy decreases between products and reactants. So how does a plant do this? The plant does it by taking energy from another source, and it puts that energy in the glucose molecule. All right, so this is a nice reaction that plants have figured out how to do. Right? So the second law states that all living organisms require input of energy. So this plant right here can't make glucose unless what is available? Unless this energy from the sun is available. Right? But here's something else too from a biology class if you ever took it. A plant can't make glucose unless another molecule is present. And that is CO2. CO2 is a basic nutrient that all plants need, right, in order to make glucose. And this is most of this is the system right here that all living systems depend on, including you. Like, where do you get your glucose from? Well, you get it from a plant But don't forget, a plant needs carbon dioxide and sunlight to do that. So this is a very important process. And the rate limiting step for most conditions, for most plants, is the concentration of CO2 in the air. So CO2 is just rate limiting molecule for what? Basically all life processes on the planet. I just find it interesting that some people want to regulate and tax that molecule. It's kind of scary, I think. Okay. So plants obtain that energy from sunlight, right? And it uses that free energy to bind CO2 and water together to make glucose, right? And then animals consume plants, and they get that free energy from the sun via what molecule? Glucose right here. All right, so let's look at this next slide. So in an animal that has glucose, that's eaten glucose, right, or if you have just glucose maybe sitting on your table as a form of sugar, you can burn it. And what do you? And maybe if you're making creme brulee or something, right, you want to caramelize some sugar, and you get carried away and it turns into carbon, or it's burned all the way to CO2. That's what we call combustion. And what do you need for combustion to break glucose down into CO2 and water? You need oxygen to do that, right? So we take the free energy that's in glucose, and when we convert glucose into carbon dioxide and water, it releases all of the energy in those carbon bonds, carbon-carbon bonds that were formed by plants. All right, so this reaction of glucose going down to carbon dioxide and water, right, where these products down here have less free energy, that's what we call an exorganic reaction. So if the products have less free energy than the reactants, that's an exorganic reaction. Products contain less free energy. Now, let's go back to the previous slide. What do we call a reaction where the products have more free energy than the reactants? That's an endergonic reaction. So energy has to come from another place, which is what? In this particular case, from a plant, then it's the sun. All right, so endergonic reactions can proceed if there is energy from some other source. So that's the next slide that we have right here. So you have many reactions in your body that are endergonic, like muscle contraction. Okay, it is a highly coordinated motion within cells. It requires energy to proceed. And what is the form of energy that muscle needs in order for it to contract? Even from anatomy, you'd realize that it was ATP. So ATP is broken down, and there is a lot of energy in those bonds. So let's plot out a couple reactions with these wheels right here. We have reactants going to products, we've got reactants going to products in another wheel, versus the free energy. Okay, so here we have products in this first wheel, kind of looks blue. What has more free energy, reactants or products? The reactants have more free energy. So this is a reaction that can proceed very nicely in terms of thermodynamics, right? But instead of that energy being wasted, what biology has figured out how to do through evolution is to connect this wheel to another wheel that can take reactants at a low free energy and make products out of it. So we can couple the blue wheel, which is what kind of reaction? An exergonic reaction to an endergonic reaction to make endergonic reactions take place. But endergonic reactions won't take place unless they are what? Coupled to some other kind of chemical reaction, right? And notice which wheel is bigger. The exergonic reaction has to be bigger. There has to be more energy, right, in the exergonic reaction than the energy in the endergonic reaction. If they're exactly the same, then the reaction won't take place. This endergonic reaction won't take place. This extra energy, this energy difference right here, is necessary for, according to the second law of thermodynamics. That's what produces the increase in entropy or randomness in molecules. Okay, so think of this blue wheel as being an ATP molecule, and maybe think of this lighter blue wheel, or is it gray? Lighter blue, as maybe muscle contraction, or some other kind of process inside your body, like maybe putting amino acids together to make a protein. Okay, so here is an important energy molecule in your body. You don't have to remember this structure, but you probably recognize it already. All right, so here is an ATP molecule. It's an ATP molecule because how many inorganic phosphate groups does it have? There are three, right? So that's for triphosphate. And then this is just an adenine nucleotide, or an adenine base right here. Sorry, I was going to ask you. What kind of molecule does this look like? Do you have a base? And what is this? What kind of sugar is this? It's a ribose. It's not a deoxyribose. It's just a ribose. And then here's the triphosphate. So this is just adenosine triphosphate. It's a nucleotide, right? It's not a deoxynucleotide. As a matter of fact, it's a ribonucleotide. And these little squiggles right here represent covalent bonds. And what kind of bond is a covalent bond in terms of the strength of all the bonds? It's strong. And as a matter of fact, this one right here that has a squiggle in it, it's extra strong. So we call it a high energy bond. So it's hard to make, a little bit hard to break under certain circumstances, but when you do, that energy is released. So when this bond is broken, that is an exergonic reaction because that energy is released. All right. And so when that energy is released, what can your body do with it? It can turn some metabolism that is what? Endergonic. It can make endergonic reactions take place because ATP going to ADP and inorganic phosphate is a highly exergonic reaction. All right, so this is just a nice nucleotide, and it's carrying energy. So it's an energy carrier because of these two bonds right here. All right, let's talk about a class of chemical reactions. We talked about kinases and phosphatases, but here's another important kind of reaction. And we call it an oxidation reduction reaction. And there was an example like lactate dehydrogenase works by this kind of reaction right here. All right, so if a molecule gains electrons via some kind of chemical reaction, we say that that molecule is reduced if it gains electrons. And that means if a molecule gains electrons, it also means that another molecule has to give up. It has to release those electrons from someplace. So if a molecule releases electrons, we say it is oxidized. All right, so reduction and oxidation always occur in the exact same reaction. Only some molecules are oxidized while others are reduced because electrons are transferred. All right, so a reducing agent is an agent that donates electrons to another molecule. That's a reducing agent. A reducing agent is available to give up electrons to somebody else. And when that somebody else receives those electrons, what happens to them? They become reduced. When they gain electrons, they become reduced. Now, this seems easy, but it's kind of a mind twister. You have to really think about this a little bit. And you got a couple exercises in the book, a couple diagrams that are exam figures to help realize this. All right, so an oxidizing agent is an agent that can accept electrons. And that's pretty much named after oxygen, because the oxygen molecule that we saw in some previous slides, O2, loves to accept electrons. Right? And so we say oxygen is an oxidizing agent because it likes to accept electrons from other kinds of molecules. Right, and don't forget, reduction and oxidation are always coupled reactions. You can't oxidize something unless something is reduced at the exact same time. All right, your book makes a big deal of saying that oxidation reduction involves the transfer of hydrogen ions instead of electrons. But what I really want you to focus on in this class is the transfer of electrons. All right, so think of oxidation and reduction reactions as being a transfer of electrons from one molecule to another. So just kind of underscore electrons right here. And we have some very important coenzymes that play important roles as electron carriers. So you could cross that out and put electron carriers. And indeed, your book is not wrong. It's just a little bit different way of thinking about it. I'll show you why that's important in the next couple chapters. And these coenzymes right here are NAD and FAD. All right, so let's go back to one of those previous slides where we talked about cofactors and coenzymes. All right, think about that, or maybe look at your slide, cofactor and coenzyme. Which one is just a small metal ion? A cofactor. And a coenzyme is what? It's a big organic molecule. All right, so that works really well for this class. So NAD and FAD right here are what? Small metal ions or big organic molecules? Big organic molecules. And you can kind of tell that from their name. These molecules are kind of so complicated that they're very difficult for your body to make, so you need them in your diet, so we call them vitamins. Right? Vitamins are necessary to make NAD and FAD. NAD stands for nicotinamide dinucleotide. Oh, what's a nucleotide? It is. A nucleotide is used to make DNA or RNA, right? It's got a ribose sugar, it's got a base, and a phosphate group. And this one right here, nicotine adenine dinucleotide. Well, dinucleotide, there's two nucleotides put together to make this compound. All right, this one here is flavine adenine dinucleotide. Let's take a look at what these molecules actually look like. All right, now these are not exam figures, so you won't have to label these things. But let's look at this first molecule right here. All right, so this is NAD, and you don't have to really know what NAD stands for. But when you look at it, what do you see? Oh, well, I see something that looks like a nucleotide right here, right? And then I see another nucleotide right here. So that's a dinucleotide. So it's just kind of a polymer of some things that you're sort of familiar with already. And right here on this position of NAD, two electrons can be put in this part of the molecule. And so then NAD becomes NADH because NAD is always positive when it is oxidized, right? So if it's missing electrons, it's oxidized. When it gains electrons, it becomes reduced, right? When a molecule gains electrons, it becomes reduced. So NADH is the form that has added two electrons to it, and NAD plus is the oxidized state right here. And then NADH can run around inside the cell and do what? Can give up these electrons to somebody else. And it just so happens that these electrons are carrying a lot of energy with them. So NADH is a high energy molecule, and you could almost think of it as, well, it probably even has more energy than ATP. All right, it's a high energy molecule. Here's the FAD molecule. Now, what do we see with FAD? Here is what? A nucleotide, but it says in the name it should be a dinucleotide, and that's just a misnomer. It doesn't have two nucleotides in it. It has this flavine group right here, and the flavine is just a niacin vitamin that has been bound to this adenine group right here, and it becomes an FAD. And just like NAD+, FAD can accept two electrons. And it can, and two hydrogens will bind to it. What's the charge on a hydrogen? Plus one. What's the charge on an electron? Minus one. So if we add the same number of hydrogens and electrons to FAD, we don't change the ionic nature, right? It just becomes neutral. So FAD becomes FADH2, but what is it really carrying? What do I want you to focus on? It's carrying high energy electrons. Electrons that are high energy that can be used to run maybe an endergonic reaction. All right, so NAD accepts two electrons and a proton. That's why it changes from an ion to a neutral molecule right here. So FAD is an oxidized state. FADH2 is in a reduced state. So probably you should know, in terms of NAD and FAD, which ones are reduced. You would say NADH is reduced. That's the high energy form of this molecule. What's the high energy form of FAD? It's FADH2 because it is what? Reduced. It's carrying those high energy electrons. So that's what I want you to realize. And now why do we call these cofactors instead of, why do we call these coenzymes instead of cofactors? Because they're not just simple metal ions, right? They're coenzymes because they're big organic molecules. They both have what? Carbon, hydrogen bonds. That's what's necessary for an organic molecule. And they're carrying something between sets of chemical reactions. What is NADH and FADH2 carrying between various kinds of chemical reactions that we're going to look at eventually? What's being carried from one metabolic pathway to another metabolic pathway? These high energy electrons. It's just able to carry these high energy electrons from one place to another. You almost could think of these as like being a wire carrying electrons from one place to another, okay, and transporting energy. All right, so that's it for this particular chapter. So we're going to move on to, maybe I'll revisit some of these concepts next time, but we're going to move on to chapter 5 next time. Yeah.
But FAD is FADH2, but the other one is
NAD. Oh, because NAD is always in an ionic form. It's always NADH. It's going to accept two electrons, but only one proton. So one electron will neutralize that charge from NAD. The other electron will neutralize the charge from the hydrogen that's added to it. A little bit different than FAD. FAD takes two protons, which has two positive charges, and two electrons that have two negative charges. So FAD electrically is neutral, and FADH2 is electrically neutral as well. Thank you so much. Okay, I'm going to turn these... Hold on, I got to make an announcement before somebody leaves the class.